Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
One, Atlas didn't shrug. Atlas slouched. He checked out. He plugged in. He turned on Netflix and played a video game. Atlas slouched. Two, what's a greater risk to your health, to your life? Cancer or guns? Obesity or COVID? Who's really listening to fake news? Three, into the darkness, and then emerges Aaron Rodgers. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to the weekend. Welcome to Friday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment, at Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. On today's episode of the Will Cain Podcast, we're going to dive into why everything is broken, why it is that trains don't seem to run on time, that we have toxic spills that end in black mushroom clouds, why your plane is always delayed, why men are listlessly walking around without purpose, hollow, like those toy figures we played with when we were children, fake muscles, empty on the inside. But first, let me begin with a contradiction. I want to talk about purpose, and I want to talk about the role of distraction, of plugging in and tuning out. I've talked about that with you for quite some time, and I am fully aware that I make the transition, the segue sometimes, from talking about finding a life of purpose to talking about the restructuring of the SEC. In today's episode, I want to ask you a question before I get serious that I mean in all levity, but I can't help it. It makes my endorphins fire. I like the conversation. It's fun. And look, I believe that life is about moderation. I say that, and I've told you I'm trying to get right with my diet. And the only real diets I've ever had real success have been hardcore. No, I won't eat that cracker. No, I can't have any sugar. Most of my life when it comes to discipline and choices is a bit like, you know, the boy trying to plug holes in the dam. If you allow any, then you don't have enough fingers for the holes that will sprout up in its wake. But that being said, you know, right now, I'm not being a Nazi. I had a cracker. I eat rice. But I'm making 80% right choices. And I do believe that life is a balancing act. I truly believe life is about moderation. You know, I was last weekend in Daytona, and I told you we were hanging out. Rachel Campos, Duffy, Pete Hegseth, Joey Jones, and myself. And Joey was talking about not drinking. His philosophy was, I don't drink, but I'm not a slave to sobriety. He said, I think when you have a dependence, you become a slave to that dependence, drugs, alcohol, whatever, wherever you find your addiction. In his estimation, many of those who cling to 345 days sober are just a slave to a different mechanism. He wants to be, in his estimation, he wants to be in charge of his choices. He wants to be able to have a drink, which he rarely wants, and know he has the discipline to do so while also having the discipline to say no. It's interesting. I don't know. I've never struggled with sobriety, but I do find it interesting in that true discipline is understanding that you can, fail without falling, that life is about moderation. It's probably about establishing some establishing some healthy ratio. You know, you don't need to be drinking seven nights a week. Is a drink once a week fine? I think so. That's up to you. You can define what is fine. When I have conversations with you, and I think almost in the way the Will Cain podcast has taken its form with you, we've done two stories in the news, two stories in politics, one story in sports. We've kind of set our ratio at 60-70% serious, 30-40% indulgence. I think it's okay. I don't think everything in life has to be of the paramount import. I think things can be distractions. There's a role for a subscription to Netflix. It's okay to have fun. You just don't become a slave to one more episode. You just don't become a slave to one distraction after another until it's 3 p.m. One more website, one more scroll, one more video, one more cookie, one more drink. But I don't think the alternative to that has to be zero. So with that, I offer you, to begin, a cookie. I offer you an indulgence, at least for me. I think I have worn people out with this conversation in my personal life, because I think I set about going on my own personal focus group. I asked people in New York City. I asked a buddy of mine in Jacksonville. I've asked a few guys in Dallas. I've asked some Californians. And I don't know why this fascinates me, but I can't help but debate this either or. Now, I think this is going to be largely for the fellas, largely for the men, largely for the fathers. But I think that women and mothers can play this game as well. It might just be harder. All right, here's my hypothetical. If I said to you, your son is going to grow up to be one of the best players in Major League Baseball, one of the absolute most famous celebrity successful players in Major League Baseball, somewhere short of Aaron Judge, maybe Bryce Harper, or your son is going to grow up to be one of the best top five golfers on the PGA Tour, something short of Tiger Woods. Let's say Jordan Spieth. Which one's cooler? And I mean that, which one's cooler? Every time I do this, I have to have the caveats laid down. I'm not talking about you going through the quick calculation of which one is going to have more career earnings. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about who's going to have a better life after his career. I'm not talking about, oh, well, I'd rather just have my son be an astrophysicist. That's not on the table. This isn't depth. This is a cookie. This is an indulgence. I think we all agree, all dudes and probably most moms, if we're staying in the realm of sports and your son, the coolest thing you can say, and by cool, I mean literally, you're hanging out with your friends. You're roughly, let's put the over under at 50 years old. And they're asking, hey, how's Johnny doing? And if your answer to that question is, he is a quarterback in the NFL, in which case they probably don't have to ask how he's doing or what he's up to. But if he is a quarterback in the NFL, I think the vast majority, the winner of the focus group, would say, well, that's the coolest. And you can scale it down, right? Johnny is a quarterback at the University of Tennessee. At the collegiate amateur level, that is the coolest, okay? I recognize that beats Olympic water polo player. I think that beats collegiate golfer. I think that beats the College World Series. I think collegiate starting quarterback D1 Power 5 is the coolest, and I don't think I am alone. Scale that up to the pros, and I'm pretty sure my son is Peyton Manning, wins the clubhouse, wins the locker room, wins the dinner, wins the card game, wins bragging rights. My question really isn't what comes in second, but my question is, what is cooler? If your answer is, he's doing well, he's up to number 3 in the PGA Tour rankings, or he's doing well, he just signed a huge contract with the Phillies, and he's batting about 300 again, 30 homers. What's cooler? Now, I thought, and this may be a reflection of the fact, I guess I've become elite, an elitist. I actually thought the answer was Jordan Spieth over Bryce Harper. We have to set aside their personalities, by the way, because that can weigh heavily in this debate as you picture Bryce Harper with his haircut and his bat flip. But we're using them as proxies, as symbols, as monikers. I thought golf had arrived at a place over the last 20 years that golf is super cool. And I don't even think it's geographic. I don't think it's racial. I don't think maybe it's socioeconomic and maybe it's urban rural. But I live in an urban environment and grew up rural. So I feel like I have a pretty well-rounded scope of vision. I think in the wake of Tiger Woods, it became incredibly cool to be a golfer. I mean, Charles Barkley wants to be a great golfer. Every football player in the offseason wants to be a great golfer. Tony Romo wants to join the PGA Tour. It's cool to be amongst your buddies and say, yeah, I'm a two. I'm a three. Handicap. I think if a dad was explaining his son, I thought that would be probably even number two behind quarterback. Man, my focus group has gone heavily against me. I expected it to be that way in the Northeast, in New York. Almost everybody said baseball. And baseball is more popular in the Northeast, at least at a professional level, than it is in, say, Texas. But every one of my friends who didn't grow up, mostly who didn't grow up in an urban environment, were quickly baseball, way cooler, baseball. They still hold to this idea that tennis and golf aren't cool. They're still soft. I really have to say, not many people have said to me, golf. I think if I just went back of the enveloping this focus group, it's probably 70% Bryce Harper, 30% Jordan Spieth. So I'm curious to ask you, if you, mom or dad, were describing your son over dinner with your friends, and you had to tell them he's either a top-tier golfer in the world or he's one of the top baseball players in Major League Baseball, which is cooler? At Will Cain on Twitter, see Will Cain on Instagram. You can hit me up on the email as well. CWillCain@gmail.com. There's the cookie.
We'll be right back with more of the Will Cain podcast.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Now it's time for the meal. Story number one. Train cars derailing in East Palestine, Ohio. Toxic chemicals spilling out all over the ground, contaminating the soil. Water supply for at least a week threatened, and possibly long into the future, because the rare forms of liver and lung cancer that are associated with the chemical vinyl chloride may not show their head for decades. A disaster, a man-made disaster of epic proportions, but not alone. Every time you look up, you can see other man-made failures of infrastructure in the United States. When President Trump visited East Palestine, Ohio this week, he quickly segued in a question to talking about Pete Buttigieg and our nation's airports, talking about the transportation secretary and his oversight of something that you may well have experienced over the past 12 to 18 months.
increase in flight delays. It seems every time we turn around, there's less we can rely on our nation's infrastructure. Revolver, a great website, had an article up this week entitled "What Happened to Hardworking Men?" In it, it's entitled "America Lost Hardworking Men Who Held Her Together, and Now She's Crumbling." In it, he has a chart that shows major U.S. power outages over the last 21 years. It distinguishes major power outages between weather-related and non-weather-related power outages. So those that seem to be induced by acts of God and those that are induced by acts of man. In the past 18 months, well, since 2021, the man-made U.S. power outages take a leap on this chart put out by Climate Central. Most people who have tracked the rise in power outages over the last 20 years are those who keep up with quote-unquote climate change, and they attribute almost all of those power outages to climate change. But what we see here in this chart is the same type of failure that leads to airport delays, the same type of failure that leads to train derailments, and that is a loss in literal manpower. What happened to men? What happened to America? What happened to Atlas? In Ayn Rand's famous book, Atlas Shrugged, she describes a society arriving at the moment of failure, where successful, hardworking men have been vilified as robber barons, as capitalistic thieves. And these men and women, these titans of industry, go on effective strike. They simply disappear into the night. They all end up living somewhere in Colorado, a place called, in the novel, Galt's Gulch. But as these innovators, as these engines of society disappear, slowly America begins to fall apart. Not unlike what's happening today. We're talking about trains not running on time. We're talking about electrical grids failing. We're talking about every industry that relies on the hardworking man slowly becoming something that does not work. I've used the word man several times, and in many of these applications, it can be a proxy for mankind. But it is also often men, literally men. Men, over, I think, the last half of century, have become, well, a shell of their former self. They have become like those toys we played with when we were kids, perfectly sculpted muscles and body with no real functional strength, no real core, no real center, no real soul, and no real purpose. There was a fascinating article up this week called "The Longhouse." It's about an internet meme that I don't really know much about, but it's the idea that much of what's happened in American society is the product of 50 plus years of establishing appropriate behavioral norms by feminine standards. That starting in, say, the 1960s with the rise of feminism, there was a vilification of masculinity. It's as though when feminism rose, masculinity had to fall. Thus gives rise to the idea of toxic masculinity. You know, naked ambition is vilified. Open conflict, open competition, frowned upon. In this article, it talks about most HR departments and a lot of upper middle management in corporate America is now inhabited by women. And along with the civil rights movement, HR departments adopted a civil rights view of appropriate behavior within work. What that means is always paying attention to someone's feelings, re-gearing human interaction in the workplace and then broadly out into culture and society towards sensitivity. In this article, they quote Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan Haidt is a thinker I believe, from the left, who's been a guest on podcasts like Joe Rogan or Barry Weiss. Jonathan Haidt said, though, this is like squeezing a balloon. You don't suppress the human desire to compete. But when you suppress masculinity, all you've done is squeeze the balloon of competition into a more feminine standard, less confrontational, less direct, but still competitive. If you think a lot about corporate environment, it is geared that way. And look, that's not to say all women, you know, connive behind the back and all men bravely stare into your face. But there are behavioral standards which have been established. And along with the rise of feminism, I think it's fair to say we have witnessed, I think we can all agree, we have witnessed a decline for 50 years in masculinity. And men today sit in a place where there was an article out this week, a new study out showing that in their 20s and early 30s, men live lives single and unplugged more than women who have significant others, boyfriends, are dating, married. You're looking at men who have been hollowed out, who are plugged in, who are playing video games, who are scrolling to the next video. And along with that loss of man, we have begun to lose much of what maintained American infrastructure. You know, I got into this debate this week with a former colleague and friend of mine at ESPN, Emmanuel Acho, who's now here at Fox Sports. I tweeted out a report from CNN.com where they talked about the medical profession, and they mentioned the disparity in racial makeup among doctors. The CNN report in their tweet says only about 6% of doctors in the U.S. are Black or African-American, about half of the percentage of patients. Experts warn that's hurting public health. I find this incredibly concerning. First, I think that in this report, there are so many problems that one should dismiss it almost out of hand. What experts? Bobby Burek at OutKick said at that point, the report is immediately dismissible. Randomly quoting experts saying this could lead to a rise in public health crisis immediately begs the question, what experts? What are you talking about? But that's not the only problem I have. In the same report, they point out that 6% of doctors are Black, while 13% of the population is Black. They wave their hand at the fact that 6% of doctors are also Latino, but 18% of the population is Latino. They don't spend much time worrying about the racial gap of doctors when it comes to Latino. And it seems to be that way in our modern social justice movement. It offers very little for Latinos, which to me shows the inherent charade in the pursuit of diversity. Which then begs the question, what is diversity? We've talked about this. Please define diversity. Because increasingly what becomes clear is the word diversity is simply a Trojan horse for the word Black. They don't mean we need more Latinos. They don't mean, in this case, we need more women. What they mean specifically is we need more doctors to be Black. To me, then, that leads to one more question. Well, what would be the appropriate percentage? What percentage would represent justice? I've always asked this. In sports, when they point out how many coaches in the NFL are Black, I want to ask, well, at what point, at what percentage would you say you've arrived at a threshold that reflects justice? 70% of the players are Black. Does that mean 70% of the coaches should be Black? Is that justice? If there's only one Black director at the Oscars nominated for an Academy Award, is that injustice? I believe of what is the Oscars up to? 10 nominees? Is it 12 nominees? Is it 8 nominees? I've lost track and lost interest in the Oscars. But same question, what would represent justice? Is it 13% of the nominated directors being black, of the nominated actors, of the nominated actresses? Is it reflective of the population? I don't know what percentage represents justice. And then I think the ultimate tell in the charade is inevitably when we point out racial disparities, and I mean this inevitably, the solution eventually gets to lower standards in order to elevate. It's either lower standards in order to elevate more minorities into the relevant pool, the relevant population, in this case, doctors, or it is to place more stringent standards on those of the disapproved race, in that case, white doctors, make it harder for white people to become doctors. In either case, lowering the standard of medical care. Here, let me try to explain what I mean about lowering that standard. In moving towards a race conscience policy. There was a group this week, it was a report on FoxNews.com that there's a group who has unveiled that the Biden administration is encouraging the IRS to address racial disparities in audits. They're encouraging every federal agency to look at DEI policies, including taking a look at algorithmic policies that lead to racial disparities, algorithmic policies. So right now, we presume, although we shouldn't presume, we should remain skeptical, that the IRS has a set of standards that would be race neutral in how they establish who will be audited. Systemic injustice, true systemic injustice in the United States of America was done away with in the 1960s with the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. That did away with race conscious policies in the United States. Now, the argument is made by social justice warriors that systemic injustice is now embodied between the lines, that it can't be seen in a code, only determined in application by witnessing racial disparities. But the code of federal law is race neutral, meaning any type of IRS auditing policies would have to be on their face race neutral. Now, it doesn't play out that way, just like everything in life doesn't play out evenly on racial, gender, socioeconomic, height, weight, parameters. Nothing comes out equally. Nothing is equitable. Because we're all of different abilities and standards and behaviors. So what we find out is Black Americans are audited anywhere from, I believe, 2.9 to 4.7 times as much as other ethnic groups. Why that may be, there's a whole host of factors that could go into why that may be. But in modern day America, we can only presume that it is because of systemic racism. Now, let me ask you, how are they going to address that? My suspicion is with the hiring of 88,000 new IRS agents, they're not going to address it by reducing the number of audits on Black Americans. What they're going to do with those new 88,000 IRS agents is increase the number of audits on white or Asian Americans. Now, how will they do that? Well, that's a great question. How will they adjust the algorithm? And how will they do it while remaining race neutral? They will, who knows, adjust the standards in some way that, in my estimation, probably will violate the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And as we've talked about on numerous occasions, we come full circle where America adopts a new neo-racist, segregationist outlook to social justice in the pursuit of equity. Just like we're talking about when it comes to doctors. You can make it harder for white people to become doctors or make it easier for Black people to become doctors to establish the ratio you feel represents social justice. But what in the end exposes the charade is I don't think any American, no Latino, no Black person, no white person cares to compromise the standards of their doctor when they're going and literally choosing their healthcare provider in a matter of life or death? No one, including the people on that CNN set, are going to make compromises because they're like, well, this guy graduated first in his class from Harvard. He happens to be a white guy. Shoot. Let's take the guy who didn't do as well because he's black. My friend Emmanuel Acho responded to that to me. He said he pointed to some statistics. He said to me, and he did eventually give me some citation because he didn't at first. He said to me, Will, empirical data states in the United States, black newborns die at 3 times the rate of white newborns, regardless of a mother's income or education. When black babies are birthed by black doctors, their infant mortality rate drops by 50%. For black women and black children, diversity is life or death. Now, what Emmanuel is suggesting here is that a black doctor has a better ability to hear, culturally understand, diagnose, and help a black patient than does a white doctor. And that results, he says, according to this study, in better infant mortality rates. It leads to some very interesting questions, one of which I asked him immediately. I said, Emmanuel, does that study show the same correlation for white patients and black doctors? Is there a higher mortality than if they had gone to a white doctor? Is the takeaway that white people should only see white doctors? Pretty interesting when it's reversed. Is it that we should readopt segregationist mentalities and only see people who reflect us, not just culturally, but racially, because they have a better ability to understand us? Or is a more enlightened society, and not just enlightened, to the point of this broader conversation, a better working society, one that says simply, hey, see the best doctor available? I think we all know the answer. And I think that's why no one would choose to compromise their doctor based upon racial standards. Just like in America, we should not compromise who's the transportation secretary, whether or not he's gay or straight. We should not compromise who runs our businesses, whether or not they're male or female. We should not compromise who maintains our infrastructure, whether or not they're white or black or trans. We should be in pursuit of the best. And for too long, I think, men have been told they are not the best. In fact, men have been told that their traits, their ambition, their competitiveness, their confrontation, their masculinity is the problem. And left in the wake is not an Atlas who shrugged, as in the novel of Ayn Rand, but an Atlas who slouched, who chose to play another game of Call of Duty, who chose to watch one more episode of Yellowstone. Men who plugged in and checked out. It's not just train derailments in East Palestine, Ohio, that have shown the hollowness of man. They've shown the lack of purpose left in modern America. And it's not just theory. It's not just an abstract conversation for you and me. It's showing up in our daily lives. It is train derailments. It is plane delays. It is compromised health care. It is landing the plane. There's a great article up on a Substack by Chris Bray where he said, we used to, you know, land planes and stuff. He perfectly puts it into the lingo of the hollowed out American Gen Z male. He's talking about the way we converse, the hollowed out nature of our argument, of our thought process. There was a free speech symposium, and I believe Yale University, where the free speech guest was shouted down by Yale law students shouted down, and cursed at by Yale law students. These are America's future lawyers, and judging by the complexion of the United States Supreme Court, possibly America's future justices of the United States Supreme Court. And their argument amounted to, shut the hell up. I don't want to hear your at which point these students walk out on a symposium on free speech, go have a session of day drinking, just like they will in their Supreme Court argument. You guys are a bunch of ass. I'm out of here. And then hit the bar, fully expecting the Supreme Court to come back and rule in their favor. Because, of course, absolutely, they can't even. Bray also talks about, we used to land planes and stuff. There's been a rise also, not just in airport delays and train derailments, there's been a rise in almost collisions in the air. If you guys saw the story just a few weeks ago, but it was in Austin, Texas, a Southwest Airlines flight and a FedEx cargo plane almost hit each other, taking off, one landing, one taking off, literally on top of each other, only because one of the pilots was absolutely sharp to see it, OODA-looped it, you know, observe, orient, decide, and act. OODA-looped it ahead of time. Was he able to narrowly escape this mid-air collision? And there's been several pilots on places like YouTube and Substacks laying out the rise, which we don't hear about often, the rise in these mid-air collisions. Failures in yet another piece of our infrastructure. Air traffic controllers, pilots, airports. We are literally compromising our infrastructure. We're literally compromising our safety. We're literally compromising our health, and we're losing our ability to land planes and stuff because we have vilified men. We have hollowed out men. We have lost men. We have lost mankind in America because we have prioritized form over substance. We have all the muscles. You know, Andrew Tate, who I think says a lot of smart things, but gives us a very shallow vision of what it is to be a man. Your kids know about Andrew Tate. Have as many chicks as you can get and drive fast cars. A hollow, shallow version, form over function of masculinity. We have all the trappings of wealth. It was another Chris Bray Substack that says, did you ever see the play or the movie or the book Grey Gardens about the old ladies that lived out on Long Island in the Hamptons who used to be wealthy and they still have everything? They have the furs, they have the china, but they literally don't pay their bills. They don't have running water. They don't have electricity and their mansion is dilapidated. I think it's based upon a true story. That's America, hollowed out, form over function, style over substance, all the trappings of society that one day one not long ago was wealthy, but now has no ability to make things work, to land planes and stuff, because we lost the men that know how to do that. Atlas slouched. He's playing Call of Duty. Would have been much more noble had he shrugged.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
Story number two. What's more dangerous to your health, cancer or guns? What's a greater risk to your life, obesity or COVID? Who's really selling fake news? Hey, my friend and colleague Clay Travis had a fascinating observation this week. Clay tweeted out the following. It's a poll conducted by Axios, 1,200 Americans. Asking Americans, broken down by political party, Democrat and Republican, what is the greatest threat to U.S. public health? Pretty fascinating. Want to work from bottom to top? Well, how about let's start with alcohol abuse. Both Republicans and Democrats, 1% say alcohol abuse is the greatest threat to U.S. public health. Climbing our way from the bottom, smoking and tobacco products. Democrats, 2% say that is the greatest threat, 4% of Republicans. How about unsafe roads and driving? 5% of Democrats, 3% of Republicans consider that the biggest threat to U.S. health. How about COVID-19? 2% of Republicans, 9% of Democrats. That is a return somewhat to sanity because there was a poll not long ago, a year or so ago, where over 50% of Democrats, when polled, all believed that over 50% of COVID cases either ended up in the hospital or in death. How about obesity? 17% of Democrats and 25% of Republicans consider that the number one U.S. public health threat. How about cancer? 9% of Democrats, 17% of Republicans. How about opioids, fentanyl? 17% of Democrats, 37% of Republicans, number one on this chart. Cancer came in at number two, or number three after obesity. Republicans, it was opioid, then obesity, then cancer. For Democrats, obesity and opioids tied for number two. Number one on greatest threat to U.S. public health was gun or firearm access. 35% of Democrats said that is the biggest threat to public health. Only 4% of Republicans. Is that an accurate reflection of reality? After Clay tweeted that, I just did a quick internet search. I wanted to see what it was. What's reality in 2022? Number one cause of death in America, cancer. 609,000. That's just among the ones listed. I believe actually heart disease and heart problems are above cancer. So these are of those listed in this poll. I didn't do heart disease because it wasn't listed here. Obesity, which is a tough one to quantify because obesity is a complicating factor in everything. I don't think it's that often written on the death certificate, you know, fat. He died fat. No, it's just, it's a compounding factor on everything else. Obesity, 300,000. COVID, which is not a statistic to trust, I'll tell you that right now, 266,000. And that's not just will conspiracy theorists. They're coming to grips with this, and they're even writing about this in places like the New York Times. COVID-coded deaths, in retrospect, were not honest and accurate assessments. To this day, we don't know, because COVID, like obesity, had so many complicating factors along with it. Opioids, 110,000 deaths, and that's with a bullet. I mean, it is on the rise. Gun deaths, 45,000. So cancer, 609,000. Guns, 45,000. This is what people don't realize about gun deaths. Over 50%, 54% are suicide. I mean, they think, I guarantee you, when Democrats, 35% say gun or firearm access, they're not talking about suicide. They're talking about school shootings. And I don't even think they're talking about, you know, inner city gang violence, which is the vast majority of gun deaths. We're talking about school shootings, which represents a tiny percentage. And then car and road accidents, 43,000. So who is getting fake news? Those that believe guns are a bigger threat to your health than cancer, or those that right now maybe over-index a little bit on opioids and fentanyl, even though it's the one that's coming up like quickly. You would tend to, if something was happening quickly, you would tend to take that threat a little disproportionately seriously. You know, it's interesting when you look at all of these, every single one of these, by the way, outside of car accidents and gun violence, outside of the suicide, you could say are health related issues, right? I mean, look, cancer, obesity, even COVID, which we know is tied to your age and BMI, heart disease, which you didn't talk about, mental health, suicide. It's all about health. Man, I remember, we need to be honest about the way we've changed in our life. And I remember there was a time when maybe I was so capitalism driven that I was a defender of, you know, big pharma. The pursuit of profits was generally honest and pure pursuit. I mean, I've changed drastically in that over the last 10 years. But I remember at that time hearing people talk about, well, our medicine is all messed up. And I thought it was messed up in terms of having insurance be the intermediary on paying. You know, anything you and I don't pay for directly is going to have an inflated price. You know, it's inflated, right? Like, we go get anything done and they charge the insurance company a ridiculous price. Like, I mean, absurd. It'd knock your socks off. And the trick is the insurance company plays a small percentage of that. And somehow they, you know, arrive at a price that is, in their minds, market rate. But what it does is it creates this incentive system where doctors and hospitals have to keep jacking it And then insurance companies keep ratcheting down their acceptance of claims in order to arrive at a market price, which would be done much better if it's the same way we bought a phone, right? I'm not going to pay this much for a phone. I'm going to go down the street and buy it for this much. Because the insurance system is in our healthcare system, prices are all jacked up. But I remember people saying this to me, and it landed on unopened ears at the time, that we have a system built upon treating symptoms medicinally and not a system built upon health. And that is absolutely true. We take medicines. We fight things after the fact. It's all doctors. Doctors, are part of this system as well. I don't mean it's all on doctors. I'm saying the way we've adopted medicine, the profit model in medicine. There's no profit in saying to your client, listen, here's what's going to happen. If you will just start eating right and exercise and do this, you won't need these medicines and you won't need to come see me and get on it early. There's no profit in that. Everything is built on solving your symptoms after you're sick. That's the modern day health crisis. That's the medicine. And that's the problem. All of these things, just treating the symptoms. I mean, how much of cancer is related to what we eat? How healthy is what we eat? How much of obesity is related to our processed foods and government created food pyramids? I mean, we're relative morons when it comes to food. Every single one of these things could be not eradicated, but dramatically reduced with focus on health and not medicine. But not if you can't, as Clay says in this, not if you can't assess risk. That was his takeaway from this poll. The number one most important responsibility of adulthood, he writes, I genuinely believe, is being able to adequately assess risk and live your life accordingly. COVID was essentially a test in that regard that Democrats completely failed. This chart confirms it's not an outlier. It's not all their fault. They're being fed a steady diet of fake news about what is actually a threat to their health. Story number three, speaking of health, Aaron Rodgers disappears into the darkness and he reemerges. What is Aaron Rodgers? The new Aaron Rodgers? I don't know. You guys heard about this, right? Aaron Rodgers in a quest. I've always been a sucker for finding yourself. Always ready to take personal inventory. Aaron Rodgers went to Oregon to stay in a cave for 18 days or so in the darkness. I wanted to read you this article from ESPN. It's really fascinating. I guess, no, Aaron Rodgers was only a four-night darkness retreat. So he went four-night darkness. He's been planning it for 4 months. He told the Pat McAfee show about this. The place that he went is a hobbit-like structure with 300 square feet of space, devoid of light, with a queen bed, a bathroom, and a meditation-like mat on the floor. It is fully powered, so at any point the lights can be turned on from inside the room. The retreat has three dark rooms, and it's been booked for the next 18 months. I gotta be honest with you, I'm pretty fascinated. I think I'd be in. You know, I need a thing. I'm always into a thing, you know, personal improvement. It reads, retreating into darkness is a spiritual practice thousands of years old with origins in India, China, and Tibet. The Sky Cave, that's the name of it, website traces the roots of darkness retreats to various ancient practices and rituals. Some medical benefits are possible, yet it states that those benefits are not scientifically proven. Remember the guy on the Will Cain podcast this last summer? Do y'all remember Colin? He's in this article. Colin O'Brady, he was the extreme adventurer who he summited Mount Everest twice. He crossed Antarctica solo. He did the Explorer's Grand Slam. Remember that? He pulled a sled all the way across Antarctica. We had him for an hour here on the Will Cain podcast. He's done it. I think he's the guy that did it for 18 days. And look, I dig this because I think you want to solve mental health, unplug, get away from these phones. Get away from the distractions. And he's the guy, by the way, said we need to go on the 12-hour walk. I didn't ever do that. I said I wanted to do that. Go on just a 12-hour walk, no phone. He really described this well. I'm trying to find this really quickly. what happens to you while you're in the darkness cave. He said the following: every day in the darkness retreat went down the same way. He had a plan of action, a to-do list on how to keep busy during the day. However, as the days wore on, those plans for meditation, breath work, journaling, and exercise went out the window. And eventually a surrender happened. They describe it as a surrender into the stillness and awareness of being in the present. O'Brady described a newfound vividness of memories, additional details, smells, and sounds from past experiences. I dig it so much. I mean, it sounds miserable to be in the dark for 4 days, but I dig that so much. Each came out of the darkness with their own personal lessons while inside the room. One of the guys they interviewed learned about forgiveness. O'Brady learned about internal fulfillment. They said at the end of the thing, Colin O'Brady went to his journal and he wrote this in big letters: "I wish I could stay. I've touched the calmest places of my soul in the dark." And he said he wanted to go back in for another 14 hours. Man, I don't think, you know what I think? I don't think this is an endorsement for going to sit in a cave for 4 days. I don't. I don't think it's an endorsement for darkness. I think it's an endorsement for calm and presence. And it's not all about our phones, because I think there's so many ways for us to constantly feed our dopamine hits of distraction. Phone, TV, even other people. And maybe I need to do this. I got some big decisions I want to make. Maybe I need to do this. And we're never present. I do believe that. And trust me, I am not a preacher. I do not practice on this. I'm just sitting here with you thinking about it. I think it's an endorsement as much of darkness, of just finding time to be still. I have a friend that's going through it, and it's not my story to share with you, but he is going through it, man. In ways that it's like you can't imagine one person having this many things coming at him at the same time. I mean it. Health, children, job, the whole thing, man. All of it at once. And he is handling it like a champ. I mean, I'm so impressed. And do you know what he tells me? He's not exercising that much. Meditation. I don't even know how long he does it. 30 minutes a day. He goes, "I meditate, and it's a chill pill for the entire day, and it centers you." And it's like talking to a stoic, somebody with just like, I'm sure there's always flaws, always frailty, always weakness, but it's like talking to somebody who can see themselves from the outside. I don't know, Aaron, I dig it. I dig the darkness thing. More than anything, I dig the pursuit of being better. And if you come out of this and you decide $59 million to continue with the Green Bay Packers is just fine, I'll get it. If you decide the Las Vegas Raiders are the right place for you to re-engage with Devontae Adams and bring the Raiders on your last couple of years in the league, if you could bring the Raiders back the way that Peyton did for the Broncos, wow, that would be a cool legacy. I think what will make me question the darkness introspection is if you come out and choose to be a New York Jet. That's going to do it for me today here on the Will Cain Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I will see you again next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.